This is Rabbi Herman Shalman, as a man of about 100 and as a young man. He was one of the Godolei Hador. It's a term we use for the great ones of a generation, our greatest teachers, our greatest scholars, our greatest leaders. You see Rabbi Shalman with the Gang of Five. He was one of five rabbinic students at the Hochschule für Wissenschaft des Judentums. Say that three times fast. He was there, they were there in Germany in 1935. They had the opportunity to leave Germany and go to Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. Rabbi Shalman was an incredible figure in the Reform movement. He was a regional director for the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. He was one of the founders of the first Reform Movement camp. Look what they've gone on to create. He was the rabbi of Congregation Emmanuel for over 30 years, president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. He was friends with Elie Wiesel. Pictures with him with Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. And at 92, he threw out a pitch at the Chicago Cubs. I met Rabbi Shalman for a celebration of the 50th anniversary of a German group called Action Reconciliation. This was a group of young adults from Germany who volunteered in communities around the world. How did the group begin? After the Second World War, volunteers from peace churches in the United States went to Germany to help them rebuild. They felt called to serve others. They felt called to help reshape the image of Germany around the world. This was the civil rights era. They felt called to help bring the message of peace. They felt called to bring reconciliation into the world. So how did Rabbi Shalman get involved with the program? He and his wife Lottie, also a refugee from the Shoah, they rejected all things German in their lives. They didn't speak German in their home. They blocked out all the memories of Germany. And Rabbi Shalman described the change. He and his wife were asked to host the first Action Reconciliation volunteer who came to Chicago. They didn't want to open their homes, but they were the only ones who spoke German that could be asked. But they encountered the sincerity of this young man, and it provided a shift in the beliefs and the thinking of Rabbi Shalman, of his wife Lottie, and their vision of Germany. Last week at this time, I was in Berlin. It was the conclusion of 2 weeks exploring Germany. Now, the reaction of some of my family and some of my friends were, how could you go to Germany? You can see the reaction here, but we also had several congregants with German roots that went this summer. It's a very, very real feeling. In 2003, I spent a week in Poland. I can still picture the stone monuments at Treblinka, stones for each of the communities that is no more. I remember standing where the ghetto was in the Warsaw Ghetto, being on the ghetto side of the remains of the wall. And the row upon row of barracks at Auschwitz. Why did I go? I needed to learn. It was moving to learn about how this country, a country of 83 million, took in 1 million Syrian and other refugees. It helped me appreciate the history of Germany. It gave me a deeper understanding of fascism, the dimensions of the Shoah, but also insights about teshuva, reconciliation, and hope. So what did it feel like to be in Germany? At times, it was surreal. Now, Germany today is a modern country. Israelis live in Germany, and I don't wear a kippah. I look like any other tourist, complete with backpack and very dapper hat. But still, pictures like this were in my mind. The Nazi boycott of 1923 of Jewish stores, and people being shamed and forced to walk through the streets with signs around their necks. But it's also surreal. You know, a couple of meals, I left the group, I just had tea or I had a dinner by myself. And with that image of Germany in mind, it struck me here I was in Germany, a country where in the 1930s I would have been ridiculed. But here I was being served by a waitress or waitress, a server, and having my dinner. So what did I learn? The first thing I learned was about documentation. And throughout the places that I went in Germany and throughout Germany, there are documentation centers. This is a picture of the documentation center, and that's what they call them in Munich. The building that you see is where the Nazi headquarters was, and it's now been turned into a place of remembrance. There were school groups there. There were tourists there. There were people there, and they learned. And they learned about how the Nazis came to power in Munich. And they learned about the atrocities. We went to Bergen-Belsen again, another documentation center. And with all of the discussions about concentration camps, I came to a real understanding of what they are. There were discussions, should the Japanese internment camps be called concentration camps? Should the camps where people seeking asylum are housed at the borders of Texas be called concentration camps? But these concentration camps were something very different. They were a place where enemies of the Nazi regime were taken, were humiliated, were broken. And Bergen-Belsen was a Soviet prisoner of war camp. But with the Nazi theories of eugenics, the Soviet soldiers were considered to be subhuman. The things that were inflicted on them, on the Roma, on the Jewish community. And these stories are not hidden. And you see here, this is a gravestone for Margot Frank and for Anne Frank. It's remembered. Berlin has an incredible monument. It's 4.5 acres. There are 271 slabs of concrete, like you see here. They're anywhere from 1 foot to 15 feet. And you can see what it's like walking up and down because it's on a hilly area. And if you could imagine a monument like this being right behind the Lincoln Memorial, it is literally in the heart of the government district of Germany. When the Berlin Wall came down, this was built shortly thereafter. And it's very eerie to walk through, to be surrounded by the walls, and to feel the downs, the ups, until you emerge. It's almost like a labyrinth from a Catholic meditation walk. Very powerful, very, very powerful. The silence, there aren't interpretations. But in many ways, as the stones envelop one, you feel enveloped the way that the victims of the Shoah were enveloped. Another piece of remembrance are what are called stumbling stones. really wasn't familiar with them. And this was a project started in 1992. There are now over 70,000 of these stumbling stones, these small metal plaques on concrete stones that are in streets throughout Germany, throughout other countries in Europe. They have the names of the victims, Jewish victims, Sinit victims, Romi victims, homosexuals, people with disability. They have the name of birth, of death, if it was known, and where they lived, the last known place of residence. So there's this subtext of remembrance, of documentation of not forgetting. Is it enough? Is it not enough? It is there. And that's what's so powerful. You know, right at one of the central universities where there was the book burning of 20,000 books in 1933, there's now a monument there, now a sculpture. It's like library shelves going down. And when it was dedicated, Wolfgang Nagel, the senator in charge of construction in Berlin, said, "No memorial, no matter how well it succeeds, can relieve us of this, but it can warn us and keep us vigilant." And there's a plaque there from a play from the 1880s by Heinrich Heine. And the quotation says, "Where they burn books, it will ultimately burn people as well." And that leads to the second realization from being on this trip, the realization of vigilance. And it's not just enough to remember. This stone, bless you, is in the area of the Jewish community, where the Jewish community was predominant in Hamburg. At the very top in Hebrew, it says remembrance. And the words at the bottom say, "Do not forget, be vigilant." In this area today, there's a school, there's a synagogue, mainly populated by Jews from the former Soviet Union. Looking into that era of the 1920s and 30s, it was a difficult time throughout the world. The Great Depression, the unresolved crises still of World War I. But isn't it a difficult time in so many places in our world today? Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Myanmar, these and other countries. Be vigilant makes me very, very conscious and very scared of any leader that will discriminate against others, any leader that will generate fear in order to advocate a position. In World War II, it was Jews, it was Roma, it was people with disabilities, it was blacks, it was people who were homosexual, it was communists. It was all about the fear. And they lost sight of humanity. What I came to realize is it's more than about just a law. It's about never forgetting the dignity of every human being. In Rothenburg, there's a museum of all of the apparatus of justice from the medieval period. You could see the different implements of torture that they used to get confessions. Judaism has this absolute, diametric vision of the world. In Judaism, when a witness is going to speak at a capital trial, they're cautioned. They say, God is not like a human sovereign. A human sovereign strikes a coin and everyone's the same. God makes every human being and each one is different using the same mold. A single person was created for the sake of peace so that no one can say that my ancestor was greater than yours. I was reading about the controversies here in the States about the political divisions about the words that were said about specters of race. And it made me very, very sad as I was continuing this journey in Germany. I was reminded of the words of Pastor Martin Niemöller, who is an anti-communist and supported Hitler's rise to power. But when Hitler insisted on the supremacy of the state over religion, Niemöller became disillusioned. He became the leader of a group of German clergy who opposed Hitler. In 1937, he was arrested and eventually confined to concentration camps. One of them was Dachau. And his words were the very famous words that we've heard. First, they came for communists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for trade unionists. I didn't speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me. There was no one left to speak out for me. Our job in the world is to speak out for people. Speak out for people. That's another lesson that I learned from this trip. And the final was a lesson of hope and human potential. After the Second World War, much of Germany was in ruins. It's a picture of Hamburg in the 1940s, a picture of Hamburg today. Wow, look at the difference. Reminds me as well about Israel. Israel, 1948, was just being established. And Israel today is this amazing modern country. There was a Syrian refugee who came to Germany and said, when I look at Germany and see what Germany has become, it gives me some hope for what Syria might be. And it wasn't just about rebuilding, but it was about remembering and vigilance and about finding another way to be in the world. And I think that's a charge for all of us. And I'd end with this last image. These are several of the young people from the Reconciliation Project. There's Marlena and Tim and Thomas. Marlena and Tim came to the United States and worked with survivors of the Holocaust. And Thomas was a community organizer in Chicago in the 70s. And there's some people that it's just too much to comprehend what happened with Germany. But we see a country with a very rich heritage. I'm still not a fan of classical music or opera. A little apple strudel is nice. But if one country could do this, it can be done. And it's a model for us. And it's a time for us to think about what happened, about remembering, about being vigilant, and about hope. Shabbat Shalom. If it's my mom, I'll call her back.